the sounds of war.
Announcement of a ceasefire for the war in Gaza as fighting continues.
How medical aid workers are responding to the news this Thursday, October 9th, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. This hour, the story of a mother who is spending her years after prison trying to prevent gun violence in Chicago.
I knew I had a dream to help people, but I never knew that this was where it would lead me.
Also, as part of our cost of living series, we look at the soaring price of pet care.
In veterinary medicine, many practices, that labor cost exceeds 50%.
Plus, Pope Leo releases a major teaching document today about poverty.
And a Hungarian novelist wins the Nobel Prize in Literature.
Those stories and more coming up after this newscast. Stick around.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. A grand jury has indicted New York Attorney General Letitia James for alleged mortgage fraud. It's the latest case brought by federal prosecutors after Trump called on the Department of Justice to target his perceived political enemies. Staffing shortages are leading to more flight delays at airports across the U.S. today as the federal government shutdown continues. The Federal Aviation Administration reported staffing problems at airports in Boston, Chicago, and Philadelphia, and at its air traffic control centers in Atlanta and Dallas-Fort Worth. Air traffic controllers are among those required to work during the shutdown without pay. Some have called out sick. On Fox Business, Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy suggested workers who call in sick could be fired.
If we have a continual small subset of controllers that don't show up to work and they're the problem children, listen, we need more controllers, but we need the best and the brightest, the dedicated controllers. And if we have some on our staff that aren't dedicated like we need, we're going to let them go.
Labor unions warn the situation is likely to get worse. President Trump says he's planning to leave for the Middle East sometime on Sunday and hopes to be there in time for the return of hostages held by Hamas back to Israel. NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports the first steps of a peace plan are moving forward.
During a cabinet meeting at the White House, Trump thanked his own staff and international partners like Indonesia, Turkey, and Qatar for helping bring about the ceasefire deal. He also said wealthy Arab nations would step up to help with the rebuilding of Gaza.
You can't live right now in Gaza. The place is it's a horrible situation. Nobody's ever seen anything like it. So, yeah, we're going to create better conditions for people.
It's unclear where Palestinians will be able to live during the reconstruction process, but the president later said that nobody would be forced to leave Gaza. He has previously suggested redeveloping the Gaza Strip into the, quote, Riviera of the Middle East. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News, The White House.
A federal appeals court is expressing skepticism about an order blocking President Trump from deploying the Oregon National Guard to Portland. As Oregon Public Broadcasting's Conrad Wilson reports, the deployment was blocked last weekend.
The Justice Department argues the president has sweeping authority to federalize and deploy the Guard over Oregon Governor Tina Kotek's objections. Trump wants 200 federalized National Guard members to help protect a U.S. immigration facility in Portland. Federal law allows the president to deploy the National Guard if there's an invasion, a rebellion, or if the president cannot enforce federal laws with regular forces. But the limitations of that authority were fiercely debated during this hearing. Attorneys with the state of Oregon and city of Portland acknowledged occasional violence at some ICE building protests, but argued that sending in the military is an overreach of executive power. For NPR News, I'm Conrad Wilson in Portland.
Stocks closed down today. This is NPR News from Washington. Pope Leo is urging Chicago union leaders to advocate for immigrants and welcome minorities into their ranks during a meeting in Rome. He weighed in as the Trump administration cracks down on illegal immigration in the Pope's hometown. The administration says the crackdown is for public safety and national security. The U.S. purchased $20 billion worth of Argentina's currency, the peso, in a currency swap with South American nation's central bank today. The move comes as Argentina's economy continues to spiral into turmoil. U.S. farmers and Democratic lawmakers are criticizing the move as a bailout, as Argentina has benefited from sales of soybeans to China amid President Trump's tariff war. The administration says it's not a bailout. Argentina's President Javier Milei is a personal friend of Trump's and is facing a critical midterm election next month. The Nobel Committee in Stockholm has announced the winner of this year's Literature Prize, as NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports.
Hungarian author László Krasznahorkai has won the Nobel Prize in Literature. The 71-year-old is known for the novels The Melancholy of Resistance and War and War. The Nobel Committee says it's honoring Krasznahorkai for his compelling and visionary body of work that in the midst of apocalyptic terror reaffirms the power of art. His first novel, published in 1985, was about a pair of swindlers and a nearly abandoned collective farm. The book was later made into a 7-hour movie. Previous winners of the Nobel Prize in Literature include Doris Lessing, Alice Munro, Bob Dylan, and Derek Walcott. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
I'm Ryland Barton. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
It is 4:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. We receive support from the Lake Country Journal, a magazine showcasing the beauty, landscapes, and people of Lake Country. The February-March issue publishes the winners of their annual photo contests, which are also displayed at the Brainerd Lakes Regional Airport. Submissions accepted all year round at lakecountryjournal.com. Weather tonight, cloudy with lows in the mid to upper 40s, gusty winds up to 20 miles per hour.
Our news, this is All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. The war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza is approaching a ceasefire. Tonight, the Israeli government is expected to formally approve the first phase of a plan to end the war. The ceasefire would follow soon after, and then the releases of hostages and prisoners. But this agreement does not immediately change the humanitarian emergency for the people of Gaza. It does give hope, however, that lasting relief may rush in. And so, today we reached out to aid agencies who would provide nutritional and medical relief. Jacob Granger is the emergency coordinator for Doctors Without Borders in Gaza. He's been there since late July. And when we spoke this morning, I asked him what the mood was like on the ground with news of a possible ceasefire.
It's very strange. This news coming a little bit from outside and telling that there will be a ceasefire, a peace agreement or something like this inside. Yes. But while we are hearing the news, we are also hearing the sounds of wars that are continuing. So we are hearing the sound of F-16s, warplanes, of drones, of strikes, and also a lot of shootings. So, it's a little bit difficult to get by and to understand what does this really mean. But for the population, for the colleagues over here, this means a lot of hope. It's a population that has been struggling in a way. It's very difficult to describe during 2 years. And right now, the situation they have is so dire that they need to have a rest, but not temporary rest, not something just for a few weeks, and then the hostility will start again. They need to have a long-standing rest to be able to recover, to reconstruct, and to be able to deal with the traumas they have, both physically and mentally.
They need a permanent end to this war.
Indeed.
Well, you are on the ground in Gaza right now. Can you just describe for us the current state of your operation there?
So we had to withdraw from Gaza City on the 25th of September.
Right, because of the ground offensive by Israel.
Yeah. We had tanks less than 1 kilometer away from our premises, the hospitals we were supporting, or the clinics we had. We had teams ready to stay despite the danger, despite the strikes happening less than 50 meters sometimes from our clinic, and the needs of the population exacerbated by several factors, the lack of food during several weeks, several months, the lack of access to clean water, to drink or to clean themselves. So the really poor access of hygiene is a problem for the health situation here. And then the lack of supply, medical supply, food, water for the population.
Okay. Well, given the circumstances right now, is your organization prepared to rush in dramatically more aid if a ceasefire allows for that?
We are ready and we are trying and we will do so whether there's a cessation of hostilities or not. The only thing that can keep us ongoing, that can avoid us to downscale activities in Gaza Strip, will be the access. So we, as other medical actors, as other humanitarian actors, we need to have an unlimited access to the population to be able to do this safely, so to have some safety guarantees from Israeli authorities and to have the supply to do so. So we need to have supply, and the only thing obstructing our ability to have supply inside Gaza Strip are Israeli authorities' administrative requirements.
I'm still reflecting on your words at the beginning of our conversation about how strange it is to hear news of a ceasefire while you are still hearing the sounds of war. What are you hearing from people in Gaza? If there is progress that could possibly end this war, how are people reacting in this moment?
It's a mix of hope, hoping that it will last, hoping that they will be able to continue to live, just to continue to live, actually, and not be at risk at any moment, at any time, killed or to be injured. Last days we had a colleague from MSF that has been killed by an Israeli strike. The 15th colleague we lost because of the military operation since the 7th of October 2020. Aside of that, there's also this thing of almost despair that Gaza is destroyed. Gaza is not existing anymore. The people are living in tents, in shelters made of wooden sticks and plastic sheeting. So it's a mix between both of them. Hope to be finally a little bit at peace, and the despair that the entire Gaza Strip has been destroyed by this war.
Jacob Granger, he's the emergency coordinator for Doctors Without Borders in Gaza. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you so much.
Pope Leo is drawing the world's attention to poverty. A new Vatican document released today describes caring for the poor as an essential Christian task. Joining us now to talk about the first major document of Leo's papacy and how people are responding to it is NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose. Hey, Jason.
Hello.
So this document is called Dolexite, or in English, I Have Loved You. Why is it called that?
Well, it's a quote from the book of Revelation, the last book of the New Testament, and it's addressed to a group of poverty-stricken early Christians who were being oppressed by the Roman Empire. So I think Leo is saying that since the very early church, God's love has been focused on those in dire need, the poor and those with no resources.
What are some of the major points that the Pope makes in this document?
Well, he reminds readers that Jesus was himself born into a poor family and lived an itinerant life, and that Jesus' ministry was to the poor, those who had not only no money, but no power in society. Pope Leo quotes extensively from the Gospels, including Matthew 25, this famous story in which Jesus tells the disciples that when they feed the hungry and clothe the naked and heal the sick and house the homeless, they are doing those things to Jesus himself. Leo goes on to say that care for the poor is not just accomplished in acts of charity or almsgiving, as he calls it, but in addressing systems that cause poverty. He calls those societal sins, systemic sin, in which all people are implicated. Here's Sister Carol Zinn, Executive Director of the Leadership Conference of Women Religious.
My hope would be, as we around the world read this exhortation, we will find ourselves in it. Like, what is my contribution to structural sin? Where do I buy my clothes? What do I eat?
And Pope Leo in the document draws attention to economic disparity, that the rich are accumulating vast wealth, while at the same time more and more people are living destitute lives. He even highlights an idea from Latin American liberation theologians who talk about God's preferential option for the poor. Remember, Leo himself spent years working in Peru among some of the most poverty-stricken people on the planet.
So on one hand, this document was in the works even before Leo was elected pope earlier this year. But on the other hand, it does seem especially timely and also political.
Well, I think any time you talk about poverty, you're talking about economics, and economic systems are political. Leo describes economic disparity as part of systemic sin, systemic oppression. That's clearly political. In fact, part of the document becomes even more pointed when it comes to addressing the plight of migrants. Leo points out that most people migrate due to economic conditions. They're fleeing poverty. And Leo quotes Pope Francis saying that a focus on poverty is also a focus on migration, that the role of Christians is to, quote, welcome, protect, promote, and integrate migrants. Here's Steve Millis, who teaches theology at Pope Leo's graduate school alma mater, the Catholic Theological Union in Chicago.
At a time like this, while masked ICE agents are roaming the streets of the Pope's home city here in Chicago, it's hard not to be seized by this message, because nothing could be more radical than saying God loves those who have no power. Those who are being deported. God loves those who are fearful in their homes.
You know, and by implication, calls to task those doing the deporting and causing the fear among migrants.
So this document has been released. What happens next?
Well, Catholics and others around the world will read it and think about it, and priests will preach on it, and Sunday school classes will teach it. Just look at what happened with Pope Francis's teachings on care for the environment. That entered church teaching. It changed Catholic college and diocese policies about the environment. It even changed the liturgy in some instances, all of which is meant to change people's minds. And as Leo writes, burst the privileged bubbles people live in and lead them to eventually, hopefully, care for their neighbors.
That is NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is your daily dose of phonology, where John Latimer looks back at his nature notes from this date. We receive support from the McKnight Foundation. This weekend on Stay Human, stories of grace, a teacher's kindness, and how it feels when things turn out right. Great music, too. Saturday morning at 9 or Sunday at 5 p.m. Now for your daily dose of phonology.
On today's date, October 9th, 1999, I spot a monarch with an injured wing. It's headed south, but whether it'll make it to Mexico or not remains a question. This is not the latest monarch that I've ever seen or had reported to me. My mother saw a monarch on the 29th of October in the same year, 1999. Prior to that, I had a monarch sighted on the 27th of October in 1990 by Brad Nett. And before that, the 27th in 2014. And other late dates would have been the 23rd in 2004. Jeff Sipper saw that one in Brainerd. October 21st in 2011 and 2001, both Harry Hutchins and Marinette saw monarchs that late. So it's not entirely out of the question to see monarchs later in the month of October. There are always some who are the last to leave the country. As I said earlier, That doesn't mean that they'll make it to Mexico. It just means that they were slow to leave Minnesota.
For NPR comes from this station and from the University of Maryland Libraries, dedicated to making UMD's research available to everyone and advancing open access for the public good. More at lib.umd.edu. And from Workday, an AI platform to manage HR, finance, and agents that aims to free business leaders from the mundane so they can focus on more meaningful work. Workday, moving business forever forward. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. A grand jury has indicted Letitia James, the Democratic Attorney General in New York, on one count of bank fraud. The move comes after President Trump pressed the Justice Department to prosecute James, who is a longtime political foe. NPR's Carrie Johnson has been following the story and is here to talk about it now. Hi, Carrie.
Hey, Scott.
What do we know about this case against Letitia James?
A federal grand jury in Alexandria, Virginia, handed down the indictment today. I'm told by a source it's a single count of bank fraud. This follows a months-long investigation this year by prosecutors in Virginia. And Scott, this process was really unusual. A Republican prosecutor who had been leading the office concluded there was not enough evidence to bring a case against Tish James. But then he was forced out of his job by the White House. And the woman who replaced him, Lindsay Halligan, has no experience as a prosecutor. Halligan is the person who presented the case to the grand jury today.
There's a lot of history that goes back between Letitia James and President Trump. Would you take us through some of it?
Yeah, James had pledged during her campaign for New York Attorney General to investigate Donald Trump, and she did wind up bringing a civil business fraud case against him and his company. In court, James won that case and won more than $450 million. Trump had been blasting that investigation as a witch hunt and calling for James to be in prison. In the last couple of weeks, the president made public a social media post that called on the Justice Department to go after James and some of his other perceived political enemies. One of them was former FBI Director Jim Comey. That new prosecutor in Virginia got an indictment of Comey last week, right before the statute of limitations expired. Comey was in court yesterday, pleading not guilty to the charges against him. His lawyer says Comey will bring a motion to dismiss that case based on vindictive prosecution.
Any reaction yet from the New York Attorney General?
No formal statement from her so far. Her lawyer, Abby Lowell, had derided this whole process as politically motivated revenge. He produced some documents suggesting James may have made a paperwork error, but nothing that rises to the level of fraud. He also pointed out the Justice Department weaponization czar traveled to New York, where he was photographed outside one of Tish James' properties by the New York Post. This is not exactly standard fare for a Justice Department investigation. Scott, also worth noting, the grand juries hear only from prosecutors, not the defense, and the standard for indicting someone is much lower than winning a conviction in court. That's proof beyond a reasonable doubt. While the DOJ instruction book for prosecutors says they should only proceed if they're confident of winning a conviction, it's not clear those rules are being followed anymore at DOJ.
Any sense of what comes next for James?
James eventually will have her day in court just like Jim Comey did. And President Trump has said recently more action may be coming against people who have crossed him. We know prosecutors have been looking at the former National Security Advisor John Bolton. His home was searched by the FBI this year. They've also been looking at California Democratic Senator Adam Schiff, a vocal critic of Trump who says he's done nothing wrong.
That is NPR's Carrie Johnson. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Okay, if you have a furry companion running around the house, or even a scaly or feathered one, you've probably felt the pain of increased pet care costs. And that is what we are looking at today on the latest installment of our series, Cost of Living, The Price We Pay. Our colleagues over at The Indicator, Adrian Ma and Darian Woods, talked to a vet from Cleveland, Ohio.
You could argue that human doctors have it kind of easy. I mean, after all, they only have to take care of one species. While vets, they might have to treat a dog and a cat, a snake and a flying squirrel all in one afternoon.
And this sort of unpredictability is what Adam Hetchko loves about veterinary medicine.
I do everything, but surgery's my thing.
We helped a pet this week that had a foreign body and an obstruction, had eaten a toy.
Can I ask what kind of pet and what kind of toy, or is this like a HIPAA violation?
This one was a squeaker toy.
Yeah, they go, hee-hee, hee-hee.
Uh-huh. So the dog had pulled out that, swallowed it whole, and it had gotten stuck. It was a lab. And labs are known for being silly and eating things sometimes.
We asked Adam straight up, what's up with the soaring cost of vet care?
Adam says the costs of operating a practice have just gone up a lot. Medication is more expensive, thanks in part to tariffs. For the same reason, medical supplies like bandages, gowns, and syringes are more expensive. Adam says a box of exam gloves costs more than twice what it did just a year or so ago.
But maybe the biggest cost pressure, Adam says, has been the cost of labor.
And in veterinary medicine, many practices, that labor cost exceeds 50% of our overall cost.
What Adam is describing here is a perfect example of a classic economic idea called Baumol's cost disease.
There are certain industries that get a lot more productive each year thanks to advances in technology, things like manufacturing. And then there are industries where productivity is really hard to increase because the jobs are just so inherently dependent on human labor.
This explains why, over time, we've seen big screen TVs and computer software become cheaper, but certain services that require human labor have gotten more expensive. There isn't yet a robot or an AI in the world that can watch your kid or administer an IV or unclog your toilet. And if we as a society want people to become caretakers and nurses, plumbers and animal surgeons, wages for those jobs have to rise over time. Otherwise, a lot of people that might have chosen to do those jobs will choose to do something else. And that is Baumol's cost disease in a nutshell.
So Baumol's cost disease helps explain the rising cost of pet care, but it doesn't give the full picture. In recent years, veterinary care has been increasingly taken over by private equity firms, and vets who work at corporate-owned practices are under significantly more pressure to generate profits than those who work at independent ones. That's according to a 2023 study.
One more reason people are spending more on pet care is that many pet owners are just willing to spend more on pet care. Adam Henschko says he's noticed a shift in the culture of pet ownership compared to a few years ago, and he chalks it up to pandemic lockdowns.
Some of the only social interactions that people had or companionship was their pets in their house, and leaning on them to get through some of those challenges, I think, only strengthened the bond.
The shift to remote work meant many people were, for the first time, spending all day with their pets. So they became more attuned to their fur babies' every hiccup or odd behavior. And Adam believes that's made many people more willing to pay for the very best care they can afford to keep their pet healthy.
I think pet owners are driving some of that up because they're looking for more options and more services.
Adam did have some advice. He says, get to know your vet and take your pet for regular checkups to help spot health issues before they become serious and more expensive to treat.
And he says you could consider buying pet health insurance. But we should say those policies are not cheap. Adrian Ma,
Darian Woods, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Following 2 years of war in Gaza, Israel and Hamas agreed to the first phase of a ceasefire deal. It could go into effect as soon as Friday. The agreement calls for an immediate end to the fighting in Gaza, and Hamas could begin releasing the last 48 hostages. We'll bring you the latest developments on the deal tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It is 429, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. We receive support from the Move It Real Estate Group, assisting clients with real estate purchases and sales for over 25 years, not only in Grand Rapids, but across northern Minnesota. Move to what moves you. More at moveitrealestate.com. The History of Jazz airs Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4 with host Paul Kibbe, exploring the distinctly American art form. Hear more Jazz Sundays at 6 p.m. with volunteer-hosted Jazz on America Avenue. Native Defense presents the second annual Our Voices Restored community event, Saturday, October 11th from 11 to 3 at the Beaux-Arts Ballroom on the campus of Bemidji State University. There will be panel discussions, local music, a community meal, and resource table. Free and open to all. Now it's time for National Native News here on KAXE KBXE.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. President Trump's Navajo pick for Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs was officially confirmed Tuesday during day 7 of the federal government shutdown. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has more.
Senate Republicans confirmed William Kirkland among more than 100 Trump nominees along party lines, while Democrats, including Arizona Senators Mark Kelly and Ruben Gallego, voted against it. Kirkland, who is Navajo, pledged to work with lawmakers to address potential budget cuts facing Indian country during his July confirmation hearing.
First of all, it's unfortunate, but tribal nations have always been asked to do more with less. Whatever dollars are allocated towards the Office of Indian Affairs by Congress, we're going to work to make sure that we get the best investment.
Kirkland enters his new interior role at a time when more than half of all staff agency-wide are furloughed. Now those nearly 31,000 federal workers and many more may not be guaranteed back pay, according to a White House memo. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Indigenous people in the Arctic have been using underground food storage for thousands of years, but the practice is changing as the environment warms. Researchers have been looking at how villages in Alaska and Arctic communities in other countries are reimagining the future of ice cellars. The Alaska Desk's Ayolna Naiden has more.
Several wooden boxes poke up above ground along the coast in Savunga on St. Lawrence Island in the Bering Sea. They are a few feet deep and are now empty, but traditionally they are filled with walrus, reindeer, and whale meat. Ice cellars, or sikluaks in Yupik, are common throughout Alaska Native communities, but the Arctic has been warming almost four times faster than other parts of the world. Researchers from the University of Alaska Fairbanks have been studying how food preservation practices have been changing. Yoko Kugo is originally from Japan and is one of the researchers who is leading the project.
We heard that some communities, not all of them, but some are having a hard time rely on storing food underground.
Kugo and other URAF researchers have been visiting the communities on St. Lawrence Island, as well as on the North Slope. They learned how food preservation practices vary depending on local landscape and diets. And they heard from residents that permafrost thaw and erosion have been causing some of their ice cellars to collapse or flood. Despite the challenges, many continue using ice cellars and hope to preserve the practice. Another UIF researcher, Michael Koski, has been working on the project as well. He says that while the climate is expected to get hotter throughout the century, underground, the temperatures should fluctuate less.
If they're willing to go a little deeper and a little further inland, there's more of a chance of making a new cellar and maintaining those traditions.
During the most recent meeting in Savunga, residents asked researchers about climate predictions and stressed the resilience of indigenous people in face of environmental change. Kugo says that overall, residents ask them about practical takeaways from their research.
They are looking for what they can do and do together.
While researchers are nearing the end of the social science part of the project, climate evaluations are continuing. Collaborations with other countries will go on as well. In Anchorage, I am Alona Knighton.
On Wednesday, Cherokee Nation leaders in Oklahoma signed an order officially establishing Cherokee Nation Flag Day, to be celebrated annually on October 8th. The day commemorates October 8th, 1977, when the Cherokee Council started the process of developing a new flag design. Leaders say the flag represents Cherokee Nation history, culture, and sovereignty. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Drummond Woodsum, a full-service law firm whose nationally recognized tribal nations practice provides services to tribal nations and their enterprises and to companies that do business with tribes across the country. More at dwmlaw.com.
Support by AARP, whose Family Caregiver Resource Guide is available to caregivers by calling 877-333-5885 or at aarp.org/caregiver-resources.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Washington. For the first time in a long time, the headlines out of Israel and Gaza are about the possibility of peace. That's because late yesterday, President Trump announced that both Israel and Hamas had agreed to phase one of the framework of a peace deal. NPR's Daniel Estrin has been covering the war since the very beginning. He has covered the region for more than a decade. And I asked Daniel to join us to talk about this moment, the hope that comes with it, as well as the skepticism. Daniel, it has been a long week, a long 24 hours. Thank you for talking to us for a little bit.
Oh, it's great to talk to you, Scott.
Let's start with that. What is the general feeling where you are? Is it more hope or is it more skepticism?
You know, everyone here has been conditioned to be skeptical for the last 2 years and 2 days, to be exact. We've seen ceasefire efforts fall through again and again. We've seen how Hamas has fought till the last man, no matter how many civilians were killed and how much Gaza was destroyed. We have seen Israel's leadership thwart ceasefire efforts repeatedly. We've seen how prolonged war has served Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's political survival. And yet, it is incredible for me to say this, but for the first time, people here really are giving themselves permission to hope.
Wow. Why do you think that is? What's different this time?
President Trump has been the X factor, especially for Netanyahu. It was exactly 1 month ago when Hamas negotiators were sitting in Qatar meeting to consider a U.S. proposal for a ceasefire when Netanyahu ordered strikes to try to kill them. It failed, but it was a pivotal moment. Netanyahu came to the White House shortly after, and President Trump said, I have a peace plan I've worked out with Arab countries. They're on board. They're going to bring Hamas on board. You better be on board too. What's different here is that the U.S. is guaranteeing that Israel will not resume the war once Hamas releases the hostages, and that guarantee is the key factor.
And Daniel, is the reason that that guarantee carries weight, is that because Netanyahu has a better relationship with President Trump than he did President Biden? Is it because President Trump has been so aggressive about threatening at times Hamas, at times Israel, saying stop this at else at a certain time, and people are by and large listening?
I think it's because Netanyahu has no other ally today than President Trump. Trump was his last lifeline, and Trump was able to get Netanyahu to stop the Iran war, and now he has done the same with Gaza.
This, of course, is not the first time a U.S. president has gotten deeply involved in negotiations, and this is not the first time that there has been a feeling of cautious optimism, right? President Clinton got very close a couple of times to a lasting deal. There were the Oslo Accords near the end of his second term. He brought Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak together in 2000, only to have things fall apart. How are you thinking right now about the durability and the future of this new peace plan?
Well, President Trump talks about this being peace in the Middle East. We're not there yet. This is phase one of a deal to exchange hostages and prisoners. This is a deal for a partial Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. If you're thinking about peace in the Middle East, this is small potatoes. It is a huge breakthrough, don't get me wrong. But the tricky part is the next stage of the deal, which is, will Hamas be disarmed? What kind of multinational peacekeeping force could be in Gaza? And then there are the very last points of President Trump's 20-point plan for the Middle East, which discuss, in these very vague terms, some kind of future pathway for Palestinian self-determination, for a Palestinian state, what successive U.S. presidents have tried to achieve. And one fundamental shift in this war is that Israel has never before spoken so openly against a Palestinian state as it has now. Yeah. And the Trump administration is avoiding more discussion of the topic. So this deal may lead down the road to diplomatic ties between Israel and other Arab countries. But if we've learned anything from the past 2 years and 2 days of war, it's that as long as the root issues of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict are not addressed, most people here believe it's just a matter of time before the next round of violence.
Let's pause for a moment, though, at this moment in time. And Daniel, tell me what in your mind has been lost on both sides over the past 2 years and 2 days, as you put it.
I mean, what hasn't been lost? Palestinians in Gaza have lost nearly everything. Their homes, their limbs, their schools, their lives. Israelis, as a collective, have fundamentally lost trust in their country's ability to keep them safe. Both peoples have experienced trauma that echo their worst chapters in history, whether that's the Nakba, the displacement of Palestinians in the founding war surrounding Israel's creation, or the Holocaust for Jews. This has bred resentment, revenge, and generations on both sides that may not be hopeful that they can chart a better path forward.
Yeah. You've covered just about every minute of this war. I still think about talking to you over the microphones in the very early hours of October 7th, 2 years ago. What moments or stories that you've experienced are sticking in your mind today?
I remember that. I spoke to you from the hospital in southern Israel.
Yeah.
Where I stumbled upon an old college professor of mine who split his time between the U.S. and Israel, and his daughter was killed in the Hamas attack on October 7th. And I called him today, and I asked him how he's feeling in this moment. And he spoke about his children who lost their sister in the attack. He spoke about his grandchildren, his grandson, who was there when his mother was killed. And this is what he told me.
I think of my grandchildren. It doesn't end for them. My grandson, in particular, when his mother died literally on top of him and his father next to him with his arm blown off by a grenade. How does one exercise that from one's memory? And at the same time, these kids went to a school for Arab and Jewish children so that they will learn to understand one another and mutual accommodation. Can they disassociate what happened to them directly on that terrible day from what is a deeply held value of the need for reconstructing relationships? I don't know, but it's going to color their life as long as they live.
You know, Scott, I've heard voices also in Gaza echoing the same sentiment that while they feel some sense of relief now, they've lost so much.
Yeah.
It's hard to really embrace a sense of happiness in this moment.
And the way he just doesn't know how the future will play out, I think that's the case for so many people, whether it's the coming days of this deal or the coming years of living in that region.
Yeah.
And NPR's Daniel Estrin, thank you for talking to us. Thank you for your coverage. And I hope we can get some sleep sometime soon.
Thank you very much, Scott.
This is NPR News.
You are tuned in to All Things Considered this Thursday afternoon here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is North Star Stories. We receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com, member FDIC. Grand Rapids artist Tom Page hosts a pop-up show Saturday, October 11th, from 2 to 6 at Clockout Brewing. Page will give a brief talk and introduce models from his paintings at 4 o'clock. It's Fall Flannel Fest at historic Kalava Hall in Virginia, Saturday, October 11th. Sloppy Joe's will be served starting at 5 p.m. with music from the Lindela Brothers from 6 to 8. Proceeds benefit the preservation of the hall. Now it's time for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories, voices from where we live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
In today's broadcast, the owner of a restaurant is sentenced in connection with the immigration raid earlier this year. Then, what you need to know about the upcoming elections. And the Minnesota Lacrosse Hall of Fame announces 12 inductees. I'm Chantel Sings. A federal judge sentenced the owner of Las Cuatro Milpas restaurants in Bloomington and Minneapolis to 8 months in prison for illegally re-entering the U.S. The man pleaded guilty earlier this month after federal agents raided his business in June, sparking protests along Lake Street. A judge said he weighed time served but imposed a prison term. After completing his sentence, the man will be deported to Mexico. Next, elections raise questions for both longtime voters and first-timers. Over the coming weeks leading up to Election Day, we'll bring you a series of stories on how elections work in Minnesota. For the first story, Jamad Jama looks at how Minnesotans can register, find voter support, and cast their ballots.
Whether or not you're a seasoned voter, it's always worth going over the basics. On November 4th, Minnesotans across the state will head to the polls. Knowing how to register, when to vote, and the ways you can cast your ballot can make all the difference.
We have a very strong civic culture in Minnesota, and I think a lot of segments of our society who are really committed to making sure that people understand the importance of using their voice. I'm Steve Simon, Minnesota's Secretary of State.
Minnesota's system is designed to meet voters where they are, and that starts with offering different ways you can register.
Voter registration basically means that you have to show you are who you say you are and you live where you say you live. And in Minnesota, we have a long and flexible list of things you can use to show either or both of those things.
From there, Minnesotans have several routes to choose from.
One is the old-fashioned way. Drop it off to a local election office in your city or in your county. The other thing you can do is to go to our website, mnvotes.gov, and very quickly and very simply do that online. The third way you can do it is on Election Day itself.
That same-day registration means that Minnesotans can still vote, even if they miss the deadline to register or move after the registration deadline. Voters who register on Election Day will need to bring identification and proof of address. And once you're registered, you have a couple options for actually casting your ballot.
One is to vote in person before Election Day at either county courthouse or city office, or some people just don't want to go into a polling place. So to do that, any Minnesotan can go to mnvotes.gov and order the ballot to come to them.
And of course, you can always vote in person on Election Day. The polls will be open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m.
My name is Luna Allen-Pekarian. I'm the Director of Public Policy for Citizens League.
The Citizens League works to provide guidance to voters, strengthen civic engagement, and reduce barriers.
A great deal of our work means being a resource that people feel comfortable reaching out to, asking questions, being directed to other organizations.
Luna says the democratic process should be accessible for everyone.
We know that folks in Greater Minnesota might face challenges with transportation, with polling place location, just delays based on broadband internet access. There have been increased efforts to make sure that there are election judges, certainly in Greater Minnesota, which just means you are helping to support people in your community to vote on Election Day.
Election judges are community members who staff polling places on Election Day. They check voters in, explain the process, and help those who need it. And in Greater Minnesota, having more election judges means better support to keep things running in smaller towns where resources can be more sparse. Voters who want to be ready for November can check eligibility and registration steps online at mnvote.gov. For North Star Stories, I'm Jamad Jama.
You are listening to North Star Stories. The Minnesota Lacrosse Hall of Fame has named its first ever class of 12 inductees, including Oneida educator Dan Neenum. Neenum dedicated his career to Native education and introducing Indigenous games into physical education. He's the only Indigenous citizen of the inaugural group and a nationally recognized expert on both the modern and traditional Native versions of the game. The Minnesota Lacrosse Hall of Fame is a virtual museum dedicated to lacrosse history and the Native origins of the sport.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. The newest Nobel laureate in literature was announced this morning. Laszlo Kronos Horkoy is a Hungarian novelist and screenwriter. The 71-year-old writer was selected, according to the Swedish Academy, for work that reaffirms the power of art in the midst of apocalyptic terror. NPR's Netta Ulaby tells us more.
Laszlo Krosno Horkoy grew up in a remote rural town in communist Hungary. A harsh, desolate place. At least that's how Krosno Horkoy portrayed it in his first novel. Satan Tango was a sensation when it came out in Hungary in 1985. It was made into an acclaimed black and white movie in 1994 that's 7 hours long. It begins on an October morning, the narrator says, before the first drops of the long autumn rains. The story takes place at a nearly abandoned collective farm where life is so bleak and so depressing the people still there are all plotting to get away. The novel was written without any paragraphs. It's just massive blocks of type. Satan Tango did not get an English translation until 2012, but one member of the Swedish Academy described it this morning as fueled with linguistic vitality. Steve Sem Sandberg said a pair of tricksters show up and seem to the people at the ruined farm like messengers of hope, or of the Last Judgment.
It is impossible to know which.
That darkness and uncertainty characterizes much of the author's work. In a 2012 interview at the Library of Congress, Krosno Horkoy was surprised, he said, that Satan Tango was even published before the fall of the Soviet Union.
For example, in this book, you will find a character from the secret police. That was absolutely forbidden, to write about a secret agent.
He got away with it, he speculated, because the decision might have been made by someone who used to be in the secret police.
Perhaps he wanted to show how big is his power.
Laszlo Krosno Horkoy took on the apparatus of power in a body of work that was also awarded the Man Booker International Prize. His most recent novel, published in English, is also about a powerless protagonist, a graffiti cleaner who writes long letters to then-German Chancellor Angela Merkel. The whole book is one sentence that goes on for more than 300 pages. You need a big sentence, Krosno Horkoy said at the Library of Congress, to write about big power. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
With no end to the federal shutdown in sight, food pantries across the U.S. are bracing for increased demand. That includes a food pantry in Grand Canyon National Park. Adrian Scabalin with member station KNAU reports.
Perched on the south rim of the Grand Canyon, the historic hotels and restaurants of Grand Canyon Village cater to nearly 5 million visitors annually. But well away from the bustle of the rim, tucked between a mule corral and housing for park employees and concessionaires, sits a small tin-roofed building. Inside, Heather Lepre is moving empty milk crates.
I'll have more of this all filled up by tonight, but I've got diapers and feminine hygiene products. And
she's the pantry's only full-time employee, coordinating volunteers, taking in deliveries, and distributing food. It's a branch of Flagstaff Family Food Center 80 miles away and mostly serves the hundreds of employees who flock to work at the park for just a few months each summer. It's already been a busy year, but with the shutdown, she's bracing for more.
I'm ready for an increase. I'm thinking about my delivery I'm expecting next week because that'll be 11, 12 days in.
Grand Canyon National Park is still open, but no one is collecting entrance fees. Most park staff are now furloughed, but essential employees like law enforcement continue to work without pay. Lepre says if this shutdown lasts a month or more, as it did last time, the effects could be dire.
It fills me with slightly a little bit of dread, to be honest. I am not used to thinking in terms of that long.
Bill Wade leads the Association of National Park Rangers. He was superintendent of Virginia's Shenandoah National Park during the 1995-96 shutdown.
I think that one lasted over two pay periods, so there were, you know, two paychecks that didn't come in.
He saw firsthand the difficult position staff were put in.
Some of the lower paid employees who were living like a lot of other Americans these days, you know, paycheck to paycheck, started having real financial problems and finding it hard to take care of their families and so forth.
Aubrey Labar is a seasonal employee at Grand Canyon.
I don't want there to be a shutdown. I don't like seeing my friends, my coworkers struggling to make ends meet, worrying about whether or not when they're going to get their next paycheck. Who knows how long this is going to last?
Labar's job wrapped up just 2 days before the shutdown hit, and she makes clear she's speaking as a private citizen. Like Bill Wade, she worries the shutdown could discourage young people from pursuing careers with the National Park Service. Or worse, the Trump administration has said it may fire furloughed workers if the shutdown persists.
I've been working seasonally for the Park Service for years, and I'm worried there might not be anything to come back to.
In the meantime, the pantry is keeping partners in Flagstaff and Phoenix on speed dial in case it needs additional food. For NPR News, I'm Adrian Scabland in Flagstaff, Arizona.
Five new albums debut in this week's Billboard Top 10 with sounds that span pop, R&B, K-pop, and hip-hop. NPR's Stephen Thompson has the details.
Next week, the story of the Billboard charts will revolve around a single album, Taylor Swift's The Life of a Showgirl. That record, which came out last Friday, has already sold more than 3 million copies, just sales, not counting streaming, which essentially guarantees that it'll top the charts next week. So it's tempting to view this week as the calm before the storm. But the charts have their own idea. Five new albums debut in this week's top 10 from a wide range of new and veteran artists across multiple genres. First up, debuting at number 4, is V by the pop star Doja Cat. It's her fourth album to hit the top 10, and she's got two songs on the Hot 100, led by Jealous Type. The rapper Young Thug hits the top 10 for a ninth time, as his new record, UY Scooty, debuts at number 6.
On the one left the Gucci socks and your sheets, yeah. Talking cars, I got every animal in my fleet, yeah.
The English pop singer Olivia Dean debuts at number 8 with The Art of Loving, while its lead single, Man I Need, surges into the top 20. The K-pop boy band P1 Harmony hits the top 10 for the first time with an EP called X. And at number 7, Mariah Carey lands a 19th album in the top 10. It's called Here For It All. Mariah Carey has now had at least one new top 10 album in each of the past 4 decades. And in case you haven't glanced at a calendar lately, her song All I Want for Christmas Is You will be back on the charts and back in our hearts before you know it. Stephen Thompson, NPR Music.
You are listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at kaxe.org. We receive support from Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's Apple Service Center in Bemidji and Grand Rapids, offering both in-warranty and out-of-warranty service on Apple products and computer repair. More at paulbunyan.net. The Virginia Public Library offers a genealogy assistance program the second Thursday of the month at 4 p.m., whether you're just starting out or fine-tuning your research. All are welcome. And Trinity Lutheran Church on Highway 71 in Lake George has a lutefisk supper Saturday, October 11th from 4 to 7:30. They will also serve lefse, Swedish meatballs, pie, and more. Weather tonight, cloudy with lows in the mid to upper 40s, gusty winds up to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow, sunny with highs 58 to 62.